Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
Black by Paul Kane. The man said, "A query?" "No," I shook my head and started to push past him. And he said, "McCary," again thickly. Then he crumpled into a heap on the wet sidewalk. It was dark there. There wasn't anyone on the street. I could have walked away. I started to walk away, and then the sucker instinct got the best of me. And I went back and bent over him. I shook him and said, "Come on, chump. Get up out of the puddle." A cab came around the corner and its headlights shone on me. And there I was, stooping over a drunk whom I'd never seen before, who thought my name was McCary. Any big-town driver would have pegged it for a stick-up, would have shoved off or sat still. That wasn't a big town. The cab slid alongside the curb, and a fresh-faced kid stuck his face into the light from the meter and said, "Where to?" I said, "No place." I ducked my head at the man on the sidewalk. "Maybe this one will ride. He's paralyzed." The kid clucked. He opened the door, and I stooped over and took hold of the drunk under his armpits and jerked him up and across the sidewalk and into the cab. He was heavy in a funny limp way. There was a hard bulge on his left side, under the arm. I had an idea. I asked the kid, "Who's McCary?" He looked self-consciously blank for a minute, and then he said, "There's two, Luke and Ben. Luke's the old man, owns a lot of real estate. Ben runs a pool hall." "Let's go see Ben," I said. I got into the cab. We went several blocks down the dark street, and then I tapped on the glass and motioned to the kid to pull over to the curb. He stopped and slid the glass, and I said, "Who's McCary?"
"I told you,"
I said. "What about him?" The kid made the kind of movement with his shoulders that would pass for a shrug in the sticks. "I told you, he runs a pool hall." I said, "Listen, this guy came up to me a few minutes ago and said, McCary, this guy is very dead." The kid looked like he was going to jump out of the cab. His eyes were hanging out. I waited. The kid swallowed. He said, "Let's dump him." I shook my head slightly and waited. Ben and the old man don't get along. They've been raising hell the last couple of weeks. This is the fourth. He jerked his head towards the corpse beside me. "Know him?" He shook his head and then, to be sure, took a flashlight out of the side pocket and stuck it back through the opening and looked at the man's dead face. He shook his head again. I said, "Let's go see Ben." "You're crazy, mister. If this is one of Ben's boys, he'll tie you up to it. And if it ain't, let's go see Ben." Ben McCary was a blonde fat man, about 40. He smiled a great deal. We sat in a little office above his pool hall, and he smiled heartily across all his face and said, "Well, sir, what can I do for you?" "My name is Black. I came over from St. Paul. Got in about half an hour ago." He nodded, still with the wide, hearty smile, stared at me cordially out of his wide-set blue eyes. I went on. "I heard there was a lot of noise over here, and I thought I might make a connection, pick up some change." McCary juggled his big facial features into something resembling innocence. "I don't know just what you mean, buddy," he said. "What's your best game?" "What's yours?" He grinned again. "Well," he said, "you can get plenty of action up in the front room." I said, "Don't kid me, Mr. McCary. I didn't come over here to play marbles." He looked pleasantly blank. "I used to work for Dickie Johnson down in KC, I went on. "Who sent you to me?" "Man named Lowry. That's the name on the label of his coat. He's dead." McCary moved a little in his chair, but didn't change his expression. "I came in on the 9:50 train, I went on, and started walking uptown to a hotel. Lowry came up to me over on Dell Street and said, "McCary," and fell down. "He's outside in a cab, stiff." McCary looked down at the ceiling and then down at the desk. He said, "Well, well," and took a skinny little cigar out of a box in one of the desk drawers and lighted it. He finally got around to looking at me again and said, "Well, well," again. I didn't say anything. After he'd got the cigar going, he turned another of his big smiles on and said, "How am I supposed to know you're on the level?" I said, "I'll bite. What do you think?" He laughed. "I like you," he said. "Bye. I like you." I said I thought that was fine, and now let's try to do some business. "Listen," he said, "Luke McCary has run this town for 30 years. He ain't my old man. He married my mother and insisted on my taking his name." He puffed slowly at his cigar. "I guess I was a pretty ordinary kid." He smiled boyishly. "When I came home from school, I got into a jam, you know, kid stuff. The old man kicked me out." I lighted a cigarette and leaned back. "I went down to South America for about 10 years, and then I went to Europe. I came back here 2 years ago, and everything was all right for a while, and then the old man and I got to scrapping again." I nodded. He'd had everything his own way too long. I opened this place about 3 months ago and took a lot of his gambling business away. A lot of the shipyard men and miners. McCary paused, sucked noisily at his cigar. "Luke went clean off his nut," he went on. "He thought I was going to take it all away from him." McCary brought his big fist down hard on the desk. "And by damn I am. Lowry's the third man of mine in 2 weeks. It's plenty in the open now." I said, "How about Luke's side?" "We got one of the," he said, "a runner. It isn't entirely over the gambling concession." "Hell no. That's all it was at first. All I wanted was to make a living. Now I've got 2 notch joints at the other end of town. I've got a swell protection in with the law, and I'm building up a liquor business that would knock your eye out." I asked, "Is Luke in it by himself?" McCary shook his head slowly. "He don't show anywhere. There's a fella named Stokes runs the works for him. A young fella. They've been partners nearly 8 years. It's all in Stokes' name." "What does Stokes look like?" "Tall, about your build. Shiny black hair and a couple of big gold teeth." McCary tapped his upper front teeth with a fat finger. "Here." I said, "How much is he worth to you?" McCary stood up. He leaned across the desk and grinned down at me and said, "Not a nickel." His eyes were wide and clear like a baby's. He said slowly, "The old man is worth 2,500 smackers to you." I didn't say anything, and McCary sat down and opened another drawer and took out a bottle of whiskey. He poured a couple of drinks. "I think the best angle for you," he said, "is to go to Stokes and give him the same proposition you gave me. Nobody saw you come in here. It's the only way you can get near the old man." I nodded. We drank. "I like your style," he said. "I've been trying to get along with an outfit of yokels." We smiled at one another. I was glad he said he liked me because I knew he didn't like me at all. I was one up on him. I didn't like him very well either. Stokes sat on a corner of the big library table, his long legs dangling. He said, "You're airing, Ben. How do we know you'll play ball with us?" His eyes were stony. I looked at the old man. I said, "I don't like that fat son of yours, and I never double-crossed the best offer." Luke McCary was a thin little man with a pinched red face, bushy white hair. He sat in a big armchair on the other side of the table, his head and neck and wild white hair sticking up out of the folds of a heavy blue bathrobe. He looked at me sharply. He said, "I don't want any part of it. Then I'll have to act on the best offer." Stokes grinned. The old man stood up. He said, "Why, damn you and your guts." He opened a humidor on the table and took out a small automatic. "I can shoot the buttons off your vest, young fella. I can shoot you for yag right now, and no one will ever know the difference." I said, "You'll know the difference for not having taken advantage of talent when you have had the chance." He put the automatic back in the box and sat down and smiled gently at Stokes. Stokes was looking at the floor. He said, $5,000 if you wipe out the whole outfit. Run him out of town, stick him in jail, poison him, anything. Wouldn't you like a new railroad station, too? Didn't say anything for a minute. They looked at me. I went on. No sale. I'll take care of Ben for that. But busting up the organization would mean sending for a few friends. Would cost a hell of a lot more than five. The old man looked the least bit scared for a second. Then he said, Ben'll do. How about laying something on the line? Stokes said, don't be silly. The old man cackled. Well, I never saw such guts, he said. I said, all right, gentlemen. Maybe I'll call you later. Stokes went downstairs with me. He smiled in a strange way. I never knew the old man to go for anything that looks as tricky as this. I guess it looks good because Ben thinks you're working for him. I nodded. I said, uh-huh. Ben's a swell guy. He'll probably blast me on sight. I don't think you'll find him at his joint. I waited, and Stokes leaned against the door and said, there's a big outfit downstate that's been running 12 trucks a week through here from the border. They've paid off for this division of the highway for years. To the old man, the last two convoys have been hijacked at Four Mile Creek, north of town. A couple of drivers were killed. He paused, looked wise a minute, went on. That was Ben. There was a convoy due through last night. They run in bunches of four or six. It didn't show up. It's a cinch for tonight. And that's where Ben will be. I said, that's fine. How do I get there? Stokes told me to follow the main highway north and where to take the cutoff that crossed 4 Mile. I thanked him and went out. I walked down to a drugstore on the corner and called a cab. When it came, I got in and had the driver jockey around until he was parked in a spot where I could watch the front door of the McCary house. After a while, Stokes came out and got into a roadster and snorted up past us and turned down the side street. I told the driver to follow him. I don't think the driver knew who it was. It didn't matter a hell of a lot anyway. I got out and told the driver to wait and walked on down Dell Street, keeping close to the fence. It was raining pretty hard again. I passed the place where Lowry had come up to me, and I went on to the corner and then went back the same way until I came to the narrow gate I had missed in the darkness. It was more a door than a gate, set flush with a high fence. I finagled with the latch for a while and then pushed the gate open slowly and went into a yard. It was a big yard full of old lumber and old boxcar trucks, stuff like that. There was a long shed along one side and a small two-story building on the far side. I stumbled along as quietly as I could towards the building, and then I went around the corner of a big pile of ties, and Stokes Roadster was sitting there very dark and quiet in the rain. I went past it and up to the building and along the wall until I saw the lighted window. I had to rustle around quietly and find a box and stand on it to see through a little square window. The panes were dirty. The inside looked like a time office. Stokes and Ben McCary and another man were there. They were arguing about something. McCary was walking around waving his arms. Stokes and the other man were sitting down. I couldn't hear a word they said. The rain was roaring on the tin roof of the shed, and all I could hear was a buzz of voices. I didn't stay there very long. It didn't mean anything. I got down and put the box back and wandered around until I found McCary's car. Anyway, I guessed it was his car. It was a big touring car, and it was parked near the gate on the opposite side of the block from Dell Street, where Stokes had come in. I got in and sat in the back seat. The side curtains were drawn, and it was nice to get out of the rain for a while. In about 10 minutes, the light went out, and I could hear voices coming towards the car. I sat down on the floor. The three of them stood outside for a minute, talking about a call from Harry. Then Stokes and the other man went off towards Stokes' car, and McCary squeezed into the front seat and stepped on the starter. I waited till we had burned through the gate and were halfway up the block, and then I put a gun against the back of McCary's neck. He straightened out in the seat and eased the brake on. I told him to go on to the old man's house. We sat in the big room upstairs. The old man sat in the big armchair by the table, and Ben sat across from him. I was half lying down in another chair out of the circle of light, and I had the gun on my lap. The old man was fit to be tied. He was green with hate, and he kept glaring at Ben out of his little red-rimmed eyes. I said, "Well, Grandpa, if you'll make out that check now, we'll finish this business." the old man swallowed. You can give me your $2,500 in cash, I went on to Ben. Then I'll put the chill on both of you, and everybody will be happy. They must have thought I meant it. Ben got rigid, and the old man cleared his throat and made a slow pass at the humidor. I fiddled with a gun. I threw a pack of cigarettes on the table and said, "Smoke?" The old man looked at the cigarettes and at the gun in my hand and relaxed. I said, "Still and all, it don't quite square with my weakness for efficiency, yet. Maybe you boys will get together and make me an offer for Stokes. He's the star. He's been framing both of you." I don't think Ben was very surprised, but the old man looked like he'd swallowed a mouse. "He's been in with Ben on the truck heistings," I went on. "He's been waiting for a good spot to dump you, working on your connections." The old man said, "That's a damned lie." "Suit yourself," I went on to Ben. "He made the $5,000 offer for your hide, in Luke's name, tonight, and he gave me the 4-mile steer." I hesitated a moment. "Only you wouldn't try 3 in the same spot, would you?" Ben finally got a smile working. He started to say something, but I interrupted him. "Stokes told me you rubbed the two boys on the trucks, too." Ben's smile went out like a light. He said, "Stokes shot both those men himself, and there wasn't any need for it. They were lined up alongside the road." Something in the soft way he said it made it sound good. I said, "He'll be around your place, no?" "He went home." Ben gave me the number, and I called up, but there wasn't any answer. We sat there without saying anything for several minutes, and then the door downstairs opened and closed, and somebody came up. I said to Ben, "What do you bet?" The door opened, and Stokes came in. He had a long gray raincoat on, and it made him look even smaller and thinner than he was. He stood in the doorway, looking mostly at the old man. Then he came in and sat down on a corner of the table. I said, "Now that the class is all here, you can start bidding." The old man laughed deep in his throat. Stokes was watching me expressionlessly, and Ben sat smiling stupidly at his hands. "I'm auctioning off the best little town in the state, gentlemen," I went on. "Best schools, sewage system, post office, best street lighting, water supply." I was having a swell time. The old man was staring malevolently at Stokes. "I'll give you $25,000, he said to me, "to give me that pistol and get out of here." If I thought there was any chance of collecting, I might have talked to him. Things happen that way sometimes. I looked at my watch and put the gun down on the arm of the chair where it was and where it looked best and picked up the phone. I asked Ben, "Where's the business going to be pulled off tonight?" Ben wanted to be nice. He said, "A coffee joint, about 6 miles north of town." He glanced at Stokes. This tried to swing it back to 4 mile when he thought you'd be there sniping for me. "The boys are there now?" He nodded. "The trucks have been stopping there to eat lately." I asked the operator for long distance and asked for the Bristol Hotel in Tally, the first town north. The connection went through. I asked for Mr. Cobb. When he answered, I told him about the coffee place and that I wasn't sure about it. Told him he'd find the stuff that had been heisted in the sheds of the yard on Dell Street. I wasn't sure of that either, but I watched Ben and Stokes when I said it, and it looked all right. Cobb told me that he'd gotten into Tally with a convoy about midnight and had been waiting for my call since then. I hung up. "There'll be some fresh fireworks out there," I said. "There's a submachine gun on every truck, double cruise. And it don't matter much," I went on to Ben, "how good your steer is. They'll be watching out all the way." Stokes stood up. I picked up the gun. "Don't move so far, Skinny," I said. "It makes me nervous." He stood there staring at the gun. The water was running off his raincoat and had formed into a little dark pool at his feet. He said, "What the hell do you want?" "I wanted you to know that one of the kids you shot up last week at 4 Mile was my boss's brother. He went along for the ride." I don't think Stokes could move. I think he tried to move sidewise to get his hand into his pocket or something, but all he could do was take a deep breath. Then I shot him in the middle of the body where he shot the kid, and he sank down on the floor with his legs crossed under him like a sailor. The old man didn't get up. He sat a little deeper in his chair and stared at Stokes. Ben moved very fast for a fat man. He was up and out the door like a bat out of hell. That was okay with me. He couldn't get to that coffee place before the trucks got there. I had the keys to his car, and it was too far anyway. I got up and put the rod away and went over to the table and picked up my cigarettes. I looked down at the old man, said, "Things will be a little quieter now, maybe. You'll get the dope for haulage through your territory, as usual. See that it gets through." He didn't answer. I started for the door, and then there was a shot out in front of the house. I ran on down to the front door. It was open, and Ben was flat on the threshold, had fallen smack on his face, half through the door. I ducked back through the hall and tried a couple of locked doors. When I came up through the hall again, the old man was on his knees beside Ben and was rocking back and forth, moaning a little. I went through another room and into the kitchen and on through out the back door. I crossed the backyard and jumped a low fence and walked back another yard to a gate that led into an alley. I sloshed along through the mud until I came to a cross street and went on down to the corner that was diagonally across the block from the McCary house. A cab came down the street, and I waited until it was almost to the corner, stepped out in front of it. The driver swerved and stepped on the gas, but he had slowed enough to give me time to jump on the running board. I stuck my head to the light from the meter. That turned out to be my best hunch of the evening because, in another second, the driver would have opened up my chest with one of the dirtiest-looking 45s I ever saw, at about 2 feet. It was the kid who had picked up Lowry and me up. He hesitated just long enough when he saw who I was. We nearly ran into a tree, and I had time to reach in and knock that cannon out of his hand. He stepped on the brake and reached for the gun, but I beat him to it by a hair and stuck it into my overcoat pocket and got him beside him. I said, "Shame on you," almost crashing an old pal like me. He sat tight in the seat and got a weak grin working and said, "Where to?" "Just away." We went on through the mud and rain and turned into a slightly better lighted street. I said, "How did you know Ben shot Lowry?" The kid kept his head down, his eyes ahead. "Lowry and me have lived together for 2 years," he said. "He used to be in the hack racket too, till he got mixed up with McCary. Lowry won a lot of jack in on one of Ben's crap games a couple of days ago, and Ben wanted him to kick back with it. Said everybody that worked for him was automatically a shill and couldn't play for keeps. But Lowry's been dropping every nickel he made in the same game for months. That was okay with Ben. It was all right to lose, but you mustn't win." I nodded, lighted a cigarette. "Ben shot Lowry tonight at the joint on Dell Street. I know it was him because Lowry's been afraid of it, and that's why he said McCary. Did you know it was Lowry when you picked me up?" "Not until I used the light. Then when we got to Ben's, I saw him get out of his car and go in just ahead of you. Then I was sure. I took Lowry up to his paws after you went in. The kid drove me to the next town south. I forget the name. I got a break on a train. I only had to wait about 10 minutes. Homicide Hunch by Robert Leslie Bellum. I was slightly plastered that evening, or I might not have fallen for the gag. But the scotch had lulled my suspicious nature, so I answered right away when somebody knocked on the front door of my apartment stash and said, "Telegram for Dan Turner." The instant I opened the portal, I realized I'd made a bad mistake. Instead of a messenger boy, my visitor was a swarthy creep named Pedro O'Mello, a tall, lanky Latin who played minor villain roles in Cosmotone horse operas and carried his villainy around with him in a private life. He had a narrow, mulish puss with black sideburns running down past his ears to emphasize the glitter in his slitted limbs, and he affected a costume that belonged only on a studio set. Velvet pants flaring at the cuffs, high-heeled boots, a Spanish jacket over a pink silk shirt, open at the throat to show how hairy his chest was. As soon as I tabbed him, I knew I was in for trouble in copious quantities. He and I had crossed swords in the past, and he bore little love for me. In fact, what he bore for me at the moment was a pearl-handled 28 automatic. He grinned as he thrust the Roscoe against my favorite vest. "Want a hole in your tweed, Snoop?" "No, thanks. The noise might disturb the neighbors." I glued the measuring glimpse on him, wondering how much chance I had of swatting his rod aside and planting a set of fives on his sneery panorama. I concluded he was too close for me for that kind of risk. I didn't have enough room to swing. He seemed to guess my thoughts. "Make a move for your shoulder holster, and I'll let you have it," he warned me. "You needn't bother, bub." "What cooks?" "Wait and see. I got a taxi waiting. Let's go for a ride. If you whistle copper even once, you'll be minus a kidney. Savvy?" I said, "Yeah." "So I won't whistle copper." He reached under my coat, frisked me for the .32 I always tote in an armpit rig. Then he pocketed both heaters, mine and his own, kept his mitt on the little .28 so its muzzle made a bulge in my direction through the cloth. "Get going." We went down to his yellow, and it ferried us out into the Tower Arms on Sunset. Presently, Romello prodded me into a lavish layout on the 7th floor, closed the door after us. I set fire to a gasper, took a hinge around the joint. The blue carpet must have cost a peck of kopecks, its thick piles seething up around your ankles when you walked on it. All the furniture was modernistic, glass and chromium tables, blue drapes, metal and leather chairs, a screwy floor lamp cast indirect light against the ceiling, and the glow bounced back down around a blue leather divan. When I piped this divan, I widened my peepers and choked. "What the?" There was a blonde quail stretched out on the glossy cushions, trussed hand and hoof with knotted ropes. Her piquant pan would have been gorgeous even without its heavy makeup. It wasn't her she-male beauty that floored me, though. It was the way she greeted me. "Dan, darling," she moaned. I gave vent to strangled noises because I wasn't her damn darling. As a matter of fact, I'd never seen her before in my life. And I've got an address book as wide as your wrist. Evidently, I've been overlooking a bet somewhere. Then, while I was struggling to cope with this screwball situation, the Romello rodent maced me over the head with his cannon. When consciousness rejoined me, I was slumped in a chair with my wrist and ankles tied like a Christmas goose. There was a lump on my thatch the size of Grant's tomb, and I had a headache built for an elephant. The wren on the divan twisted around to hang the gander on me, being careful not to disarrange her golden coiffure. "Poor Dan," she whispered. "I'm so sorry, honey." Pedro Romello sneered down at me. "Ready to spill, gumshoe?" I said, "Yeah, ready to spill your clockworks all over the precinct as soon as I get loose from these ropes." "Don't be that way, pal. The only thing it'll buy you is some more lumps. I want Mort Pollock's key." I twitched as if I had been jabbed with a lighted cigar. Till recently, Mort Pollock had been a .22 caliber talent agent in Hollywood, a crooked heel who used his offices on the Sunset Strip to mask any number of illegal shenanigans. Mort had made the serious error of committing first-degree killery on one of his lady friends during a blackmailing operation, and I pinned it on him. As a result, the state convicted him and rendered him defunct in the gas house at San Quentin. I had no regrets about this. Pollock was guilty. He took the rap, and that was that. But I didn't know anything about his keys, and I said so, emphatically. I'd have used gestures, but my dukes were too well tied. Romello leaned down, breathed in my kisser. "You lie, Sherlock. You've got it, and I want it. Maybe you'd better explain what key you mean." I tried to spar him away. He said, "Look, Pollock stashed $10,000 in a safety deposit box somewhere in town just before you sent him over the road. I think you've been waiting all these weeks for the heat to die before you opened the box and glommed that cabbage. But you waited too long, see? I found out about it, and I'm cutting in for the whole wad. Pollock owed me about that much, anyhow. So this is where I collect, when you give me the key." "Nuts to you," I grunted. "You're as haywire as snowballs in San Diego." "You think you can dummy up on me, huh?" He took mincing steps across the room. "So, okay, start belching or I get rough with your sweetie here." He meant the doll on the couch. I said, "She's not my sweetie, so go ahead. I don't even know her name." That drew a sobbing protest from the golden-haired Jane, together with a reproachful stare. "Dan, darling, how can you say such a thing when we've meant so much to each other?" "How much have we meant to each other, babe?" "Oh, please, don't try to keep up the pretense. There's no use lying to Romello. I've already told him you and I are engaged. He forced me to. I tried to keep it a secret, but he beat me with his fists." I said, so that's why he nudged me up here? Yes. Then she began whimpering as a Latin louse bent over her, started slapping. First his right hand would smack her cheek, then his left would jolt her the other way. She couldn't stop him on account of the ropes that bound her helplessly. The guy was thoroughly businesslike, I'll say that much for him. I strained at my own bonds, but all I drew were some shaved places on my wrists and an assortment of blisters on my disposition. Dan, the gazelle wailed faintly, don't let him. I can't stand it. I guess she'll have to, hun. What can I do? Tell him where the key is, please. For an instant, this didn't make any more sense to me than 6 acres and a poker deck. Then suddenly, I caught hep to what she was driving at. Okay, skunk. I yelled to Romello, lay off or I'll spill. He bent his narrow puss in a smile. That's much better. Now, give. I haven't got it on me. You know that. You probably frisked me while I was unconscious. Sure I did. So just tell me where to find it. I fished a quick lie out of my head. It's in the lower left desk drawer of my office downtown in a smaller envelope. You know where my office is? Yeah. And if this is on the level, I'll come back. Turn you and your sweetie loose. Otherwise, it's going to be just too bad. He went to the door, powdered. As soon as I couldn't hear his footfalls in the corridor any longer, I copped an irate hinge at the yellow-haired dish on the divan. Fine kettle of herring, I growled. I know. Please, don't blame me. I was at my wit's end, or I wouldn't have dragged you into the mess, Mr. Turner. At least she had quit calling me darling, I noticed. I said, how's for spooning me the lowdown? Who are you, and what's the score? My name is June Dawn. I was Mort Pollock's girlfriend once upon a time, long before you fastened that murder on him. Oh, and you held it against me, huh? Not at all, she said swiftly. He got what was coming to him. That's not the point. What is the point, then? She drew a deep breath. Pedro Melo kidnapped me because he knew I used to be friendly with Pollock. Pedro figured I'd know about the key to Pollock's strongbox. Well, but I didn't know any more about it than you do. No matter how hard Pedro beat me, I couldn't tell him anything. He wouldn't believe me, though he thought I was holding out. I said sarcastically, so you issued me an invitation to your troubles? Yes, she blushed through the admission. I needed help, and I knew of your reputation as a clever detective. I fibbed to Romello, told him you were my fiancé. I also told him you had Pollock's key. Mighty nice of you. What was the idea? Isn't it rather obvious? I figured Romello would bring you here, which he did, and I figured it'd help me. Which I didn't, I said sourly. Her glimpse widened. Oh, but you have helped me. You've chased Romello off on a false trail. He'll be gone at least an hour or so. And when he comes back without the key, he'll convert me into Undertaker bait. I made a bitter mouth. He won't even find you here. Me either. I've been working on these ropes for quite a while. My wrists are just about loose. She tugged and her mitts slipped out of the knots. I glued the flabbergasted gaze on her as she sat up and started working on her ankle fetters. Presently, they fell away and she drifted towards me. She dredged a penknife out of my pants pocket, hacked me free of the cords that trussed me. When I finally stood upright, I spent a full minute trying to get the circulation back into my arms and legs. The chick watched me sympathetically. She piped, isn't there anything I can do to make up for pulling you into danger? You can do this, babe, I grunted. Then I slid my arm around her and helped myself to a kiss. She didn't object, apparently. At least she didn't struggle. I sank my mitts in her shoulder, held her at arm's length, and shook the daylights out of her. Okay, tramp. Now come clean, or I'll take you apart from your beauty, I snarled. What do you mean? I mean, you've been feeding me a lot of these horseradish. To start with, Pedro Melo didn't slug you with his fist. Your hair isn't even must. But, I rasped. In the second place, it would be impossible for you to loosen any of Romello's knots. I tried it without making so much as a dent in them. A scared look slithered into her optics. You, and in the third place, Mort Pollock never had any 10 grand stashed in a safety deposit box, I said. If he'd had that amount of Gitas, he'd have hired a mouthpiece to defend him at his murder trial to keep him from going to the gas chamber. Wait, listen, quiet, I growled. The whole thing smells like a plant of some sort, a frame. You and Pedro Mello ran a whizzer on me, and I yearn to know why. Her pan went 3 shades paler than adulterated milk. You've got to trust me, Mr. Turner, Tan. Then her arms coiled around my neck. I was a sucker, of course. A guy in his right mind would have laid a haymaker on her dimple and scram, but this golden hair honey was a lovely bowl of cherries, and I never could resist natural blondes anyhow. I remembered later, she seemed to be listening for something. Suddenly, she tightened her grip around my neck, pulled me close. Dan, darling, kiss me, my sweet, she begged loudly. From the doorway, a voice raged. You dirty bum! I bounced 3 feet straight up in the ozone, landed upright and squinted stupidly at the party who just ankled in. He was a bald, middle-aged bozo with a pus like a full moon and glims that blaze like bonfires. Oddly enough, I recognized him. He was a Cosmotone director by the name of Maxie Shannon, an expert on cheapy westerns. He directed most of the horse operas in which Pedro Romero played minor villains. Now he lurched towards me, mouthing at the yap. So you're the dirty louse who's been stealing my wife. I said, hey, wait, is this Jessie your wife? She's not yours anyway, although anybody thinks so. I've got a good notion to. Even as he swung on me, a Roscoe sneeze, ka-chow, from the kitchenette doorway. Baldy toppled forward on his profile, slugged a dent in the carpet with his trumpet. He was deceased before he stopped bouncing. Then the concealed heater blasted again, and a hornet stung me over the ear, put another crease in my haircut. The impact short-circuited my fuses. I went bye-bye. When I snapped out of my trance, Maxie Shannon's remainders lay sprawled in front of me. The only thing new about him was an automatic in his welted right duke and a scrap of paper in his left, neither of which been there when he got creamed. I dragged myself closer to his carcass, took a blurry hinge at the scrap of paper, with an anonymous note telling him that his ever-loving Frau was playing around with another man, and giving the address of this blue and chrome teepee, which explained why the poor slob had busted in, accused me of playing fast and loose with his home life. But who had shot him from the kitchenette and then tried to push a pill through my skull? Who had planted a gun and a note in Shannon's defunct clutch? I couldn't ask anybody because there was nobody in the joint to talk to. The blonde doll had taken it on the lam while I was senseless. I was all alone with the bald bozo's remnants. I staggered to my pins, stuck a gasper in my face, set it on fire. The smoke helped, but not much. There was a cellarette in one corner, though, and I found some first aid in it. Ordinarily, I never guzzled gin, but gin was all I could see. I sloshed about a pint of it past my tonsils, waited for it to do its work. Presently, I began to feel normal. With normalcy came another discovery. I lamped a .32 automatic on the floor, recognized it as mine, the one Pedro Romero had lifted out of my armpit rig when he first put the snatch on me at my own apartment stash. It had been fired recently. You could smell the burned cordite in the muzzle. Then I caught hep to the setup. Romello was the rodent who had drilled his director, Maxie Shannon, and he'd pulled the kill with my personal rod. But how had he got back into this igloo? I knew he hadn't come in through the front doorway, or I'd have spotted him entering, since I hadn't been out of the room at any time. There was no back door either. I checked on that. Moreover, none of the apartment windows opened on a fire escape, so that theory was nixed. In brief, the front door was the only possibility. Yet the Latin louse hadn't returned that way. To make it worse, this front portal was now locked and bolted on the inside, which meant Romello and the blonde cupcake hadn't departed by the doorway route after Shannon was chilled, and a 7th-floor stash was too high for them to have jumped out the window without serious damage to their complexions. Yet they were gone, leaving my guilty Roscoe behind them. So there I was with a guy who'd been croaked with some of my private bullets, and suddenly I heard a pounding on the door. A voice said, "Open up in there, the law." I could guess what had happened. Some nosy neighbor had reported the sound of gunfire, put in a bleat to the bulls. Now I stood a good chance of being jerked to the Bastille on a homicide beef, and the frame might stick, too, when you considered how the set had been dressed. I was alone with a corpse in a locked room. My cannon was responsible for the killery, and I had no witnesses to substantiate the screwy truth. I prodded my mental machinery into high gear, while the cop out in the corridor renewed his pounding. There had to be another way out of this wiki-up. Otherwise, Pedro Romello and the golden-haired tomato would still be in my midst. The question was, which way had they powdered? Then I tumbled. There was a dumbwaiter in the kitchenette, one of those pint-sized elevators they use in the swankier joints to lower the garbage and bring up the morning milk. So that was how the Romello polecat had returned to blast his director and frame me. It was also how he and Shannon's blonde widow made their subsequent getaway. I went into action. I scooped up my automatic, holstered it. I also grabbed the other gun, the one in Shannon's defunct fist. I put this in my pocket, and then I dragged the murdered guy into the kitchenette, crammed him into the dumbwaiter. I lowered him until I felt the cage touch bottom, slid my own heft down the cable just as the cop smashed his way into the living room. I wasn't in the clear, though, not by a long distance. A basement is no place to find yourself with a cadaver on your hands when the law is on the prowl. Luckily enough, I piped an empty galvanized trash can nearby, a big one with a lid on it. I lifted the lid, stuffed Maxie Shannon inside, covered him. 2 minutes later, I ankled into the rear alley and ran. I pelted once around the block, then skulked toward my parked jalopy. No other bulls were in evidence, and I slid under the wheel and drove off as if nothing had happened. It was like shooting fish. Now I was in the clear, and the sensible thing to do was to go home, forget all about the Shannon bump off. Nobody could possibly finger me, the way things stood. I'd been lucky enough to bust myself out of a nasty spot. But I wasn't satisfied to dismiss the frame Pedro Romello had tried to drape on me. I craved large slices of vengeance, and there was just one way to collect. That would be to put Pedro's sideburn in the cooler, maybe the blonde Tessie too. I stopped at a druggery, bought some adhesive tape for my damaged dome, and thumbed the phone book. Got Maxie Shannon's address. It was on a swanky street just this side of the Beverly Hills line. I rolled there in a hurry. A cute little French maid opened up to my ring. "I'm sorry, Monsieur. My mistress is not at home. Neither is Monsieur Shannon. I do not know when they will return." I could have told her Shannon would never, except in a mahogany box. But I kept it to myself and said, "Okay, sweets. I'd just as soon talk to you another time. What are you doing next Thursday night?" She blushed. "Madame does not give me any time off. Besides, I do not know you, Monsieur." "You will, in time. Meanwhile, I'd like some questions answered." I gave her a squint at my special badge. Her dark peepers popped. "You are a policeman, no?" "No, I'm a policeman, yes. Just the private snoop, looking for some inside dope." "Concerning my employers?" "Mais non, Monsieur. It is not ethical for a servant to repeat gossip." I grabbed her gently but firmly, pulled her close to me. "Now look, Frenchy. I like you, see? Your glims are like stars. Your stems belong behind footlights." "I think I comprehend, Monsieur," she giggled. "Good. Now, we are going to be pals, or do I have to slap the ears off you?" But this is fantastic, Monsieur." "It'll be catastrophic unless you tell me what I want to know. We'll start with Mrs. Shannon. What was her maiden name?" "Why, Pollock, June Pollock." "Does she love her hubby?" I do not think so." "Has she any boyfriends?" "Oui, but I shall not give you his name. Hit me if you wish." I kissed her instead. Then I barged back to my bucket, fed it a ration of Ethel. After a while, I anchored in the alley behind the Tower Arms on Sunset, gumshoed down to the basement. It was no job at all to lift Maxie Shannon's shell out of the trash can where I'd left him, but when I began probing at his bald spot with a long blade of my pocket knife, it wasn't so easy. Surgery isn't in my line. I kept at it, though, and presently I had the slug that had joined him with the angels. I lugged him out to my coupe and propped him in it. Then on a hunch, I went back down the steps to hunt for a janitor's phone. Sure enough, I located one. In a trice, I was connected with a chromium and blue apartment on the 7th floor, which by now was apparently infested with homicide dicks, called from headquarters by the copper who'd busted in. A familiar voice answered my ring. I said, "Lieutenant Donaldson, please." "This is Donaldson." "Turner talking," I said. "How would you like to put the arm on Maxie Shannon's murderer?" David yowled. "Shannon? So that's where all this gore came from. But how did you know about it? How do you know he's been bumped? How did you figure I'd be here investigating a case without a corpus delicti?" "Stow the questions, cousin, listen." I gave him some hurried suggestions. rang off before he could demand details. Then I went out to my iron, headed for La Brea. I had to drive with one hand and hold Shannon's corp with the other. Pedro Melo's wigwam was a cheap cottage in a bungalow court. I toted the late Maxie Shannon onto the front porch, braced him before me as a shield rang the bell. Romello's voice filtered through the thin woodwork. "Who is it? And I don't want any. Telegram for Mr. Romello, sir." I hooked him with the same gag he'd used on me. He opened up. I thrust Shannon at him like a ventriloquist dummy and disguised my tone. "You thought you'd kill me, but you made a mistake, you stinking skunk." The lanky Latin let out a yeep you could have heard from Wyoming to Woonsocket. Then he pulled his little .28 and began blasting. I felt the bald director's husk jerking in my grasp as the slugs bunted him in the chest. Then I let him topple as Romello's Roscoe clicked empty. Romello got his first gander at me, and his peepers bulged like squeezed grapes. "You!" "Yeah," I said, and handcuffed him. Then a wildcat hit me in the shape of Maxie Shannon's blonde widow. She tried to claw my optics out of their sockets, but I objected to this. How could I appreciate her gorgeousness without my glimpse? And she was gorgeous, no doubt about it. I swatted her with my open duke, put everything I had behind the poke. It almost tore her profile off. She sat down on the rug, glassy-eyed as a 10-day drunk. Romello rattled the nippers on his wrists. What's the idea of? I gave him a pleasant smile. You're under arrest for croaking Maxie Shannon. You were smitten with his wife, but Maxie probably refused her divorce. So the two of you decided to fix him up with a nice resting place in some graveyard. You can't, I said. You also decided to make a double-barreled job while you were at it. Oddly enough, Mrs. Shannon happens to be the late, unlamented Mort Pollock's sister. So naturally, she harbored a thick grudge against me for sending him to the smoke chamber a few months back. Therefore, the scheme was to murder Shannon and pin it on me.
Prove it.
Okay. You rented that Tower Arms apartment temporarily. It's a scene of an operation. You lured me there, fed me a silly story about a missing strongbox key, which was a lot of nonsense. In a little while, you left, but you sneaked right back in again by the dumbwaiter. And? The Jane staged a little act with me. Meanwhile, you had sent Shannon a note telling him his wife was at that address with another man. Shannon walked in, spotted her in my arms, whereupon you corpsed him from the kitchenette with my rod. Do tell, he sneered politely. I said, yeah. Next, you tried to cream me with a second gun. The slug notched me on the noggin but failed to render me defunct. You didn't know this, though. You figured I was dead. So you put the second cannon in Maxie's mitt, tossed mine on the floor, made it look as we burned each other down in a pistol duel. You locked up the wigwam from inside, and finally you took your girlfriend down the dumbwaiter. Romello bared his grinders. A very clever song, Hawkshaw. The only trouble is you can't make it stick. Sure I can. Or, anyhow, enough of it to make you sniff cyanide. You just emptied a whole clip of pills into Maxie, which inserts your nose in a ringer. They can't execute me for shooting holes in corpses. He was dead when you shoved him at me. The bullet that killed him came out of your automatic. How would you know that? Because I... All of a sudden he turned gray around the edges. Oh my God, he moaned. I stepped aside so he could see Dave Donaldson standing on the porch, getting an earful. Nice confession, huh, Dave? Dave grunted, yeah, and uses his own cuff to nipper the yellow-haired Shannon widow. Up on your tootsie, sis. Let's all go down to the jug. So, I didn't have to wait until Thursday night for my date with the French maid after all. Her employer was deceased and her mistress was pinched for it, so she had her evenings free.